Congratulations!
Yet another out recording wherever we can get it. With me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Mason Wazwaz.
Hey everybody, this is Kate from the future, letting you know that the episode this week got a little discombobulated, because it was my birthday. Thank you everyone for the birthday wishes. This episode was recorded on multiple occasions, and just trying to get a coherent glob of audio into your ear. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is for you to donate to Indigo Mind, celebrating the work of Oliver Sacks, who sadly just recently passed away. So this may also serve as a kind of celebration of life. Here's what it says on their Indiegogo page. Indigo Mind is an ambitious group exhibition celebrating the work of neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, opening on September 26th at the Storefront Lab in San Francisco's Mission District. The project features artists who explore a range of brain and body phenomena examined in Sacks' research. You can go to their Indiegogo. I have a link to it in the underworld. They're getting close to their goal. And some of the artists involved are friends of the show, Cassie Thornton, Cara Levine, Casey Gray, the Axis Dance people, Monica Valentine, Carlos Perez, James Pitt, Carissa Potter, Tamara Seal, Catherine Sherwood, and Desiree Holman, and many more. They got perks. Give them some money. Check them out. If there were any other events I was supposed to mention from listeners that I haven't mentioned, send them to me again, because maybe they got mixed up in the shuffle. We're going through a lot here, getting building up for this audio tour that's going to be in the Root Division show on September 12th. Been a little crazy here at old Congratulations Pine Tree. And now, more of the show. All right, we got a little listener feedback. They're asking us to plug their show, which we will gladly do. And that show is at Aggregate Space in Oakland, with this listener, Cinta Schumacher, with Mae Wilson and John Tronzor. And that show is over there at Aggregate Space until September 19th. And it'll be open for Art Murmur on September 4th, 5 to 8 p.m. I do have a listener request, she writes. As a person who has just earned her MFA, I would love some tips from you and listeners on how to keep up momentum and how to network / promote yourself / make art friends without seeming weird. After graduation, I struggled with a few months of utter confusion and malaise after having a whole team of people behind me. Now I'm on my own. Holy shit. Anything to address the weird free fall post-MFA feeling is greatly appreciated.
Just keep up the good work, Santa. This looks like you're doing great. You got shows. Maybe you have a studio space, a stud, as Kate calls it.
I think it's only an appropriate reaction after grad school to go into some kind of weird funk afterwards. Everyone I know who, when they got out of grad school, had some weird thing. Some people get divorced. Some people have a baby right away or get married right away. And I think they do those things only to deal with the depression, the post-MFA depression.
That's a great way to deal with
it. Just have a baby.
Yeah. Just have a baby, everyone.
Adopt a cat. Whatever you can get your hands on. But no, that's really bad advice.
I like this question. I want to know how you answer it. How do you promote yourself
without making people feel weird?
I don't know. I think I'm not a really good person to ask for advice on that because I don't think I do a great job. I have a newsletter, but I've only sent out like 2 newsletters so far.
Maybe just start a podcast where you become a personality in the Bay Area and everyone wants to follow you on your website and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and maybe even your YouTube page.
There's so many ways to go about that. Like everyone I know that teaches some kind of like professional development class is all about like, you know, get your mailing list together, make sure everyone who might be interested in your work always knows when you're having a show or when you're having an event or whatever, get people to together, throw your own events. It's like always be networking, always have your business cards with you and all that kind of shit. But I don't know if that really helps. I think
maybe it makes you feel like it helps, and that's part of it.
You could take a little marketing workshop if you want to really get into branding yourself and all that shit. But I think people kind of forget, like, you also have to really focus on your work, right? And like be devoted to your work and be persistent, even when you may not get attention, the attention that you want, or you may not get like the shows or success that you think that you deserve. But you have to just stick with it, because there's going to be parts of everyone's career where you're not at whatever place you think you should be. And that oftentimes people just give up. We could get a little outside help on this one. So we're in a back room, a weird naked room, talking to Michelle Manser, director of Root Division. And since you have an MFA and have worked with tons of MFAs, fresh ones and stale ones, if you had any advice for that listener.
When, as you're finishing up your degree, I had one of my professors at the time say, you know, you're kind of head in, or, you know, balls to the wall to get your MFA show together and like complete that, your thesis work or whatever it is, but that to start something while you're still like in your last semester that will like, you know, kind of like throw you into your, sorry, throw you into your work in the months after you get out of school. The other thing, I mean, what I did when I graduated, I got together with three other grad students, you know, graduating grad students, and we rented a space, shared a space together. And so that was really helpful, just to be around other people, even if you don't work, have the same working hours, or the, it's not like you're talking to each other all the time, but it's just nice to have that presence as opposed to feeling kind of alone in the world. Eric Johnson, Josephine Taylor, and Leah Wilson, and I got a space down at Yosemite Place. And then I would say the other thing is just get out and go to things and meet people and just stay involved, you know, whether it's the gallery circuit or nonprofits or even like the schools, you know, gallery shows. I think that that's really important. I know, you know, I did this for a while, and I know a lot of other people do it, is if you have like a favorite group of colleagues, is to put together a critique group, or even just like a drink group where you like loosely talk about art, you know, once every other week or even once a month, just to kind of keep you active. Be present.
If anybody else wants to weigh in on their post-school life advice, self-promotion advice without being a creep, I'm sure you've got a lot of opinions. Give us a call, 419-351-6606. You can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast. Don't forget our website, congratulationspinetree.com, where if you'd like to, you could give us a little donation. You can also text our number, or if you see me, you can just hand me a note. Got a little listening treat here for you with Kari Marbo. Am I still saying it correctly?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I have a middle name too, if you want to use it.
What is it?
Keech?
Like, Kari Keech Marbo.
Like a peach. I know, it is alarming. Yeah, that is, you were not the first to have that reaction.
How's it going? What are you working on?
It's good.
Can you actually tell us about your practice first, like what you're working, like what ideas you're working with, and then we can go on?
When I was in grad school, my practice kind of evolved into basically something that looks at sight. And that's in a bunch of different ways, and then also combines that with a little investigation into memory and memory storage specifically. Like one piece from my thesis show was I had asked the Berkeley Art Museum if I could use any of their internal advertising to put a piece on, or to make a piece out of. And there are, you know, that strange entrance on Bancroft into the museum where there's a strip of internal advertising. It's just signs, kind of these panels. Mm-hmm. And so usually they're talking about museum shows. and whatnot. But for some reason, they let me do do a piece on one of those. So it was this 4x4 panel, and I couldn't touch it or do anything with it. I just sent in a PDF of the image because it was all unionized, all of that, which is great. And so I guess Larry Rinder like approved it at some point, which I thought was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And then it went outside, and it was a text piece, just white letters, black background, that talked about what it was to be an artwork sitting exactly in that space. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of on the brink of being inside the museum, but you're kind of eternally stuck on this precipice. And also you're sitting next to a Calder, which isn't bad. You know what I mean? Like if you're stuck outside and you have your friend Calder there, it's fine. Visually, it's fine. I think that I would consider a site-specific work. And then I've also done pieces like last summer, Nathan Lynch, who's the chair of the ceramics program that I work in over at CCA, he did this really, really beautiful set of three ceramic buoys, giant ceramic buoys for Bay Area Now 7. He really likes storytelling also, and so he had asked a bunch of artists/writers to write pieces that were influenced by his work or corresponded to it in some way. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. Like, that's all the email said and the invitation said, which is fantastic. And so as part of their programming for Bay Area Now 7, we got to come in and, you know, awkwardly use a microphone to read aloud these stories. And Maria Porges did one. And Michael Swain did a hilarious one that ended with a kind of like holding up a bright yellow zipper to Nathan's pants and unzipping it, which was just,
I love Michael Swain.
Yes, I know, I miss him. So, yeah, so for, you know, Nathan had certain ideas that he was working with about the rising tides and rising, you know, costs of living in San Francisco and his own themes that he was talking about within that piece and those buoys. But when he extended it to us to think about, you know, it was open and thinking, you know, I was thinking about memory and memory storage and also the rising tides. And so I wrote a short story that talked about those buoys as actual like capsules created by neighborhoods. So, you know, the neighborhood where you live in San Francisco, you'd whisper all of your memories into these buoys and they'd get captured. And he had these giant like corks in parts of them, holes with, I don't remember if it was cork or not, but it was some sort of plug. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to riff off of those because it looked like if you unplugged them, something was absolutely going to happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, I, you know, said that basically if you bottled up all of your memories and experiences and recorded them into this kind of archival material, you know, ceramics, then as the waters rose, basically people went from living in their houses, then living upstairs, then eventually they kind of tethered these buoys, these receptacles to, you know, signposts and street lamps and anything that was on the ground. And then as, you know, the waters lifted everybody up, people moved into houseboats and they traveled by water and these buoys bobbed around. And if you forgot one of your ground memories, you could essentially open one of them up and then listen to it. Mm-hmm. But eventually, you know, times change and the water gets high enough that you start to forget the city below you. And also everything rusts and materials don't last forever. Non-ceramic materials. And so the devices that had tethered these buoys to the ground eventually rusted and broke. And so the buoys ended up floating out into the ocean. And then the decision that you'd have to make is, do you stay and make new memories or do you follow your old ones out into the sea?
Tell us about what you're currently working on.
So we have a faculty show in October, and I'm also doing another collaboration with Erin Colleen Johnson at Jacksonville University and also in the fall. So this summer I had started thinking about, you know, what I wanted to put in those and what would be exciting to do in respect to ceramics and, like, you know, the exploration of it as an archive material, you know, something that really just, I had heard from Deborah Villoma, the chair of textiles, about how the history of textiles was actually embedded in clay because people would roll out clay. And so the patterns that are in those slabs, that's the earliest documentation of
textiles, because all the textiles, of course, deteriorate over time much, much faster. This is my fourth semester teaching and, you know, just getting really into this material. And so, and I really wanted to talk about the drought. So I was just doing a deep Google search and I'm looking at California because I love California. I moved here about 8 years ago. I think it's a very magical, wonderful place in, you know, in respect to the environment and politics and culturally and just, you know, cat-wise, like everything. And I just love it. I came across this article in the Wall Street Journal that was speaking about what has been revealed or uncovered because of the drought. And so we're in the fourth year of the drought. And, you know, obviously we've seen so many changes because of that. I'm starting to feel it like mentally and emotionally. I think, you know, we're all trying to be very conscious of water. We're looking at the industries that use a lot of water. But I, you know, there's sort of, it's, you know, and it's been hot. There's something happening psychologically. I believe that to be true. So this article had mentioned just in passing this, not in passing, there was a short piece on it within this larger article about Folsom Lake. Folsom Lake is a reservoir that was created in 1955. Before that, there were a few communities that had been established in the area around the Gold Rush times. In 1955, or, you know, shortly before, the U.S. government came in and said, hey, listen, we're going to make a lake here. It's a reservoir. It's going to feed Sacramento and feed Folsom. We're going to make a dam. You know, the prison is right there. So these things are going to exist now. So everybody needs to move out. Mm-hmm. And so all of these decisions have to be made in respect to, again, transitioning your memories from one site to another. So you have to, so people have to decide how to navigate that situation. And so there's one family, the Davies family, and they live in this community called Red Bank, which is very close to the shore, and that'll be important later. Essentially, they, you know, they talked about it for about 2 seconds, and then one, you know, they decided that they wanted to bring their whole house. So they moved their entire house to Folsom, which isn't that far away, but I thought it was kind of impressive. A few other families also decided to move their homes, but they also, people also had the option of just leaving them and having the government purchase a home for you. So to me, that's an exciting moment where you're saying, okay, well, do I have enough invested into this home, not just financially, but memory-wise, and do I need to bring these bricks with me to have those carry over? People left and they brought their homes and they brought whatever belongings they wanted to, and maybe they'd accidentally forget some, or maybe they'd deliberately leave some. You know, there's a lot of different options there. And they left, and then the lake was created, and then that was that. Unexpectedly, in the 70s, there's a drought, and the water gets low enough that those communities are actually exposed. So people go back to their homes. They had no idea that they were going to be able to do this. And other people are walking down, too, to see foundations of dairies and this barn where they used to have dances. And the Davies family goes down and they're flooded with memories. And so, and the editor of the Folsom Telegraph, Don Chaddick, who I've spoken with, he wrote a series of articles about what that was like. And so then, you know, then time goes on and the lake fills back up. And so everybody goes back to Folsom and you can't see your homes again. So then what ends up happening is, you know, the lake fills back up and everybody, whatever, goes on with their lives. And then this cycle of the drought, it's happening again. So I went out there about a month ago and had talked to a park ranger and Don Chaddick and the history museum that's there, and just started doing research on the site. And, you know, that's how I know a dairy was there in the Davies family. Started reading up about it. And they also had to transfer a graveyard because, as the park ranger told me, they learned that the hard way with another dam where a graveyard wasn't transitioned. And I guess over time, the bodies kind of jiggled loose and it looked like a really, really dark, like bobbing for apples scenario. Anyway, now they move them.
I just wonder how dedicated they are to matching the bodies back up with their gravestones.
Unfortunately, yeah, how true they are to that. And I don't know enough about it, and I love our country very much. But I did notice that there were some pretty rough racism going on in the relocated graveyard. There were no names for whole sections of people, which I think is awful. But I don't know enough about it to really speak beyond that. I just made some observations. When I came back, I started to think about, okay, well, how do I address this? One of the elements of this site that I really appreciate is the fact that it's, you know, every now and then it will dry out and then it gets covered with water again. So that makes me think about, okay, what happens to memories, like memories made on the ground or, you know, people's experiences there, even memories that are housed within objects there, if that's possible. What happens to those when they're covered with water? Are they preserved or do they leak out? And then what happens when they dry up? Does that mean that they evaporate? What happens when they're covered with water again? Sometimes that can be really good for something. Like for wine, you want your barrel to breathe, right? So maybe that could be a good thing. Maybe it strengthens the flavor of the... I don't know. But that was one thing that I started to think about. The other is that there are... The ground is just littered with like old bricks and foundations and a few different types of objects. So mostly china and nails. There are a ton of nails. There are a lot of tools whose function a lot of them I have no idea what these things are for because they're from the dairy or from a different time period. And, you know, gold rush up to the 1950s. And the handles will be missing, so it's just the heads or just parts of it. I've seen some mattress coils there. I saw a very strange chair that was kind of like bolted down, which I couldn't tell if that was... If somebody had said, you know, this chair will not leave the head of this table, or is it, yeah, or is it just a chair that happens to be bolted because for dairies, you know, whatever, the cows like them bolted? I don't know. cows prefer bolted chairs. So, yeah, so then I went back to my studio after that visit and started to, in clay, think about the fact that you cannot actually, because it's government property now, you cannot bring any object out of that site. So you can move them around a bit and people will make piles of nails and stuff as, you know, like they did last year. And then I believe I was one of the first to go down this year because I was watching the water elevation pretty closely. And, you know, I don't know who else is interested in that. Yeah. So I was curious about the fact that you couldn't move these, you know, objects outside of this given area, outside of the lake area. So I started to create ceramic sculptures based on those objects and kind of wrapping them up and thinking about, well, if you did want to bring them home with you, like how would you embed those memories into these new sort of objects that you can transport? And how do you take them with you? Because I'm guessing that if some things were accidentally left. Sure. And I'm also guessing that, you know, they've had this their own new strange life of preservation underneath the water. So that's one of the ways I've started to kind of visually explore the site, and those will be present in these two upcoming exhibitions.
But I just wonder if artists that make objects, if they put more emotional weight onto objects that they haven't made. I just wonder about that.
I don't know, maybe. Well, and I think that for the objects that were left and are now at the bottom of this lake, I don't necessarily mean to say that they're very, you know, important in a particular way. I think that like objects can accidentally or, you know, deliberately get embedded with memories or ideas of the past. And maybe that's, you know, a moment where something is worn down, like the pencil you use, you know, or I don't know, or maybe it was like one of the nails that put up the barn. I think that that's, you know, equally important as a wedding dress.
That's it. Do you have anything else that you'd like to say to listeners or requests from listeners? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, you know, if listeners, if you guys have images of Folsom Lake that you've taken recently, especially in that area of the communities, I'd love to see some of those. I know we had a couple students coming from that area and they were kind of reporting back on water levels and interest in the site.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, and as always, congratulations.
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 Congratulations. You've listened to another episode of Congratulations Pine Tree. Have a great week, and we'll see you on the flip side. Don't forget to call in, write in, tweet in, or whatever. Keep on creating.